Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I want to say thank you to the Historical Society for having us here. This is a wonderful space to be surrounded by our history, and that's first and foremost. And to have Francis here with us, visually as well as spiritually, is so much a part of what we're going to take away from this evening. We have tremendous panelists, writers, scholars, researchers here that are going to share their love of Frances Harper and her commitment to equality that are about to take to the podium. So if you'll join me in welcoming Dr. Lena Abdul, Sonia Sanchez, and Dr. Melba Joyce Moore. As they come, I want to explain the way this evening is going to work. We're going to ask each of the panelists to take to the podium for about 10 minutes or so of the opening remarks. And then from that point on, we'll be able to begin a conversation, a discussion of this tremendous individual. The archetype, I think Dr. Abdul has said earlier this afternoon at Temple University, the archetype of the poet protest, or the protest poet, and discuss and deconstruct and sort of learn to embrace something, what I know I did not know. I'm like Larry. You know, Larry called us up and said, hey, I'm having this meeting, come out and talk about this wonderful poet. And I said, what poet? And he said, Frances Harper. And I was like, well, I thought I knew something of poetry. I don't know this individual. And then about six or seven weeks later, he inundated our email boxes with all of this information. And over the next 6 or 7 months, I've come to love this writer. And I hope that you love her too. I would be remiss if I didn't at least start with her words. And so if you'll indulge me, I have to do the poem. Bury me in a free land. It's in your program. Make me a grave where you will, in a lowly plain or a lofty hill. Make it among earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where men are slaves. I could not rest if around my grave I heard the steps of a trembling slave. His shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom. I could not sleep if I saw Lash drinking her blood at each fearful gash, and I saw her babes touch torn from her breast like trembling doves from their parents' nest. I'd shudder and start if I heard the bay of a bloodhound seizing their human prey, and I heard the captives plead in vain as they bound afresh his golden chain. If I saw young girls from their mother's arms bartered and sold for their youthful charms, my eye would flash with a mournful flame, my death-pale cheek grow red with shame. I would not sleep, dear friend, where bloated might can rob no man of his dearest right. My rest shall be calm in any grave, where none can call his brother slave. I ask no monument, proud and high, to arrest the gaze of the passers-by. All that my yearnings spirit craves is bury me not in a land of slaves. Ladies and gentlemen, Frances and then Walker on Harper. I'd like to ask first if we're going to go from left to right. First, we have Sonia Sanchez. Sonia Sanchez is a professor emeritus at Temple University, internationally renowned. She has 16 books, including Morning Haiku. Professor Sanchez was the first presidential fellow at Temple University and held the Laurel Carnell Chair in English.
She's been honored by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Pennsylvania Coalition of 100 Black Women, the National Black Caucus of State Legislators, the Governor's Award for Excellence in Humanities, the Peace and Freedom Award, and a Pew Fellowship in the Arts. She's lectured and read poetry in over 500 universities, colleges, and organizations. Across the United States and abroad, including Africa, Cuba, England, the Caribbean, Australia, Nicaragua, the People's Republic of China, Norway, and Canada. And she is an activist, a mother, and a poet that puts her life on the line, Sonia Sanchez.
And Kamika, if you had done my African American lit class, you would have studied this woman. Yep. Just an aside, many years ago, a woman by the name of Jean Hudson, who was the curator at the Schomburg, when I had answered an ad for the New York Times. I had just gotten out of Hunter College. I was 19 and a half. They wanted a writer for their firm. And I answered this ad, and they sent a telegram. I don't think they do telegrams anymore. They sent a telegram that says, report to work on Monday. And lo and behold, I went in my apartment there in Harlem, and I looked at my father and said, C, I can't get a job as a writer. My father said, dear Sonia, you just, since you take an exam to be a teacher, just in September, you go to the teacher's job, right? And I put on that Monday my blue suit, my blue hat, my blue shoes, my blue purse, and my white gloves, and went downtown at 8:30, actually, for this job. And the receptionist came in, and she looked at me, and I handed her the telegram and said, C. And she said, oh, well, come inside. She opened the door. I sat down. At about a quarter to, a head came around, and I looked and smiled. And then about 10 minutes to, another head came around. And finally, about 5 minutes to, a guy came out and said, I'm sorry, the job is taken. And I said, how could the job be taken? I said, then I did my New York humor. I said, oh, I know, you told me to arrive at 9 a.m. I got here at 8:30, so what I'm going to do is go outside and come in at 9 o'clock and everything will be all right. He didn't laugh. He just said simply, it's taken. And then I said, well, I'm going to report you to the Urban League because I sense discrimination here. And I left and I took off the hat and everything and got on the train. If you know the New York train system, you know if you're on the 2 or 3, you have to get off at 96th Street, otherwise it goes over to the east side, and I didn't get off at all. And as a consequence, I ended up at 135th Street, gonna walk down to the Urban League, and there was a place called the Schomburg. Oh, thank you. It's been a claustrophobic for a moment. The Schomburg. And I said to the guy, what is this place? And he says, it's the Schomburg. I said, what is it? He said, lady, go inside. And I went inside, he said, sign in and go inside. I went inside, and Ms. Hudson, who was the curator of the Schomburg, was behind this great glass door, and the old Schomburg had a long table about to there with all these scholars sitting, and I knocked on the door, and I told her who I was, and I said, what is the Schomburg? She said, oh, my dear, the Schomburg is a library that has books only by and about Black folks. And I said, with my smart self, I said, there must not be many books in here. And every time I brought my students from Amherst, from Temple, to the Schomburg, every semester, she always would remind me and my students of that, and they used to say, we got something on you. But the first time I was there, she gave me 3 books. Up for Slavery, Souls of Black Folk, and Their Eyes Are Watching God. And that whole summer, I went back. When I finished those books, then she gave me anthologies of poetry, and that's where I discovered Frances Harper. And so it's not by chance that when I started teaching, Frances Harper was always included in African American Lit. And I started teaching at a place called San Francisco State in 1967. I call this the thunder of an angel, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, reconciling us with ourselves and helping us reclaim our histories. There is an ancient Vedic saying, If you want to create a new body, then you must step out of the river of your own memory and see the world as if for the first time. And our sister, Ellen Watkins Harper, used new memory to help us see the world of our foremothers and mothers and ourselves as if for the first time. Her books, written for us and herself, keep us human, keep us immersed in all that is human. All of the women, Perrin and men, she writes about must have been born feet first, must have slid out of the darkness of their mother's wounds into the light of their eyes, running on a fast track. This Harper woman of sun and moon, downloading herself into an arena called education, women's clubs, suffrage, journalism, temperance, abolition, this womanist, this careful craftsperson of words and life, aristocratic word sorcerer with a commoner's eye, informed us that activism and work that flows from the heart is God-conscious activism. Her eyes, opening like crystals, look back to Africa and plantations, forward to America and cities, told us to take God out of the sky and put God in our hearts, our feet, our hands, and our mouths, and we did. We heard the sacred in all of her footsteps as she reset the identity of these new Africans on the world stage from tragedy to the celebration of themselves and their families. She introduced the idea of women and men coming together, organizing, speaking around the country. She sat down with the people, held them when they cried, laughed out loud with them, welcomed their souls, and held their hearts in her hands. This warrior woman turned the river of memory and made the river turn black. This woman's words were a cantihondo, a deep song of Africa, of America, for she came with the staccato speech and rhythm of the spirit, and her passion entered our bloodstream. This woman no longer wrote or spoke for herself. Something began to move through her. We could see it move between the beat and the unbeat, the noise and the silence, the darkness and the light. A moment when the sounds rose from her throat, entered our blood, and we became the sheroes and the healers and the leaders. This woman levitated language and motion and soul, and she wept, laughed, organized, lectured, hummed till time stood still in the 19th and 20th centuries in America. This woman, through her hard and often dangerous work, has summoned the duende, the spirit of all of our ancestors who had suffered and yet survived and did it with dignity and grace and order and beauty. This woman told us that we had affirmed life, 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 that our eyes had abandoned defeat and death, that our feet were dancing silver as we ate a little earth, as we all must do before we die. This woman, heavy with the smell of herstory and history, put her feet on this American spine and bid us look up at our gospel hands, hanging bamboo poems of life. This woman heard Ezekiel ask, "Oh Lord, can these bones live?" And she said, "Oh Lord, they can," and we did. She helped our tribal memory re-enter our bloodstream to erase the dead prince. Give me the spirit, Lord, 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 Lord. Give me the spirit, Lord, Lord, Lord. Give me the quicksilver courage so I can spread it over my face and mouth and save my people, and save my people. Give me the strength, Lord, to bear the wrath of this country, to bear the wrath of this country, because I preach and I teach and I pray as an equal. Give me the spirit tongue of a thousand sons. Give me the spirit tongue of a thousand sons to warm our hearts, O Lord, to warm our hearts, O Lord. Give me the spirit, Lord. I say, give me the spirit, Lord, to come awake in your thunder so that our eyes can see behind trees. Help us remember, Lord, to ask. Help us to remember, Lord, to ask. Are we not more than hunger and music? Are we not more than harlequins and I can't read my writing, and harlequins and whatever? Are we not more than color and drums? Are we not more than anger and dance? Praise. I say praise God for this woman, Lord. I say praise God for this woman, Lord. Hey, bobo, hey, bobo. Give me the spirit, Lord, to put on my eyes, and forever, O Lord, let me be in the eyelash of your memory, where there is always the sound of a woman, a woman, a woman, a woman, 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 like Frances Harper. Thank you.
Dr. Lena Abadou is a professor of English and the director emeritus of the African American Studies Department at Towson University. Her specialty is oral traditions in African American novels, and her publications include the poetry of Paul Ernst Dunbar and the influence of African aesthetics, along with Mary Stewart, Womanism, Black Nationalism, and the Rhetoric of Black Preaching. She is currently working on a new text, on Frances Harper. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Lena Abadou.
Thank you very much, Tamika. And good afternoon, Philadelphia. I bring you greetings from Baltimore, the birthplace of Frances Harper, where she's still not as widely known as she should be. I often tell the story of how Harper, I was giving a presentation at Morgan State University, where Harper, there is a hall named for Harper Tubman Hall, a residence hall. And I gave the presentation to several mature women. It's a group called Morgan's University Women. And they all came up and thanked me afterwards for the presentation because they said, oh, well, we know about Harriet Tubman, but didn't know who Harper was. And so she was born in Baltimore in 1825 on Camden Street at the site of Camden Yards. Some of you might be sports fans, and that's where she grew up. But I'd like to talk to you a little bit today. What Larry asked, what my understanding of what he asked me to do was to kind of give my experience as reflecting my generation. So what I'll do is talk to you about my experiences as a teacher scholar, researching, studying, and teaching Harper. First of all, I'll begin with a little bit of my background. You know, when did I come of age? I came of age in the 60s and 70s, and I was part of that generation. We came up on the heels of people of the 60s who paved the way as revolutionaries. And so we like to think of ourselves as those who could just protest just because we could. You know, we would just protest for protest's sake. So I brought a little bit of that to my worldview, and it shaped the way that I, you know, that I teach and the text that I choose to teach. when I began teaching Harper, it was the late 1970s. I just saw her as a poet from Baltimore. She was anthologized in a book that I was using then. It was called Black Writers of America. And it was edited by Richard Barksdale and Kenneth Kinneman, 1972. It was published in 1972. And for years, that was the only anthology, one of the only anthologies that we used well into the 80s. And so they were talking about people like Sonia Sanchez as present-day generation. This was in, you know, in the 1980s as part of the Black Arts Movement, as a present-day younger generation. And so Harper, she was, I didn't really teach her as part of a poetic tradition. I didn't see her in that way at that time. You know, that was begun by Africans brought to America like Lucy Terry and Phyllis Wheatley, those griots. And I didn't include her as part of that lineage. I taught her, I'll just share with you what the Black Writers of America, what those editors had to say, how they described her. But first of all, they called her Mrs. Harper. Now, none of the men were called Mr. So-and-so, but she was referred to as Mrs. Harper, so that was kind of demeaning, you know. And so, well, this is what the critical overview in her, the biographical, you know, in the anthologies, there's always an introduction to the poet that gives you a biographical background. And I'll just give you an excerpt of how they describe her. Quote, the subject matter is slavery. It's abominable practices and abuses. Many of these poems the author recited to great effect in her lectures. Some of the pieces are poor imitations of Longfellow and Whittier. It's, you know, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and John Greenleaf Whittier, the abolitionist poet. But throughout most of the second half of the 19th century, the public bought and read her book in spite of its mediocrity, end of quote. So, when I taught the course, there were two poems anthologized. It was Bury Me in a Free Land, and I think it was The Slave Mother was the other. Or The Slave Auction, right. There were only two, because she knows the book. She's been around teaching probably longer than I have. But at that time, there was no formal incorporation of, analyzing gender in putting together my syllabus until 1989 or 1990. So what happened? That's when I participated in a Ford Foundation grant workshops in which we analyzed text and we looked at race, gender, and class, and how could we incorporate these into the study of American literature. And then later in 1995 through 96, we participated in an NEH grant, and we also did something similar into incorporating multiculturalism, race, gender, and class into the study of American literature. So it was then that I began to develop an appreciation for a viewing eye of literature with a feminist consciousness. So Harper then I began to look at her more deeply and to realize that Black women had in fact helped to establish and shape this literary tradition. So I then revised my syllabus to include Phyllis Wheatley as the mother of African American literature. Now, even though she's not first in the book that I use, like an anthology and a survey course, I revised it to acknowledge her as the mother of African American literature. And Harper had in fact continued that tradition by producing poetry using similar but distinct voices as part of a tradition that was rarely connected to this long history of poetics, aesthetics, and intellectual ideas. So, it then began to learn a little bit more about Black women and their influence, especially in the women who had crafted, for example, the slave narrative tradition, and how the slave narrative was very gendered. So for years, we had studied only Douglas and Equiano and Roper as representative of that genre. So it wasn't until the 80s that we began to study women's experiences because of feminist scholarship that came about. So I began to appreciate Harper in a new light. So I looked at her in the poetry that she did, I began to reflect on her, looking at my generation, the 60s coming about, during the 60s was this explosion of poetry during the Black Arts Movement. And like Harper, these poets wrote poetry that addressed the urgent political upheaval of the time, just as Harper had addressed the political issues and social unrest during her time. The new Black poets created poetry to achieve social change and bring about moral and political revolution. How they went about achieving it was similar to the way Harper did these changes through her poetry, but yeah, it was also different. Like the 60s poets, she embraced an aesthetic that emphasized the functionality of the art. That is, art for the people, art that came out of the community, rather than art for art's sake. And she always forged ties within the community. Earlier today, I was talking about how I actually came to Philadelphia. Curious about Harper, I went to Mother Bethel AME Church because I knew she had ties to the Unitarian Church here, and I had spoken with people there, and I got a lot of information from them. But there was something missing. Well, what was this AME connection? You know, in Baltimore, she had she had been reared by her uncle, who had been a member of the Sharp Street United Methodist Church. And so she still kept those ties to Methodism, but she chose to be a member of the Unitarian Church. So she, in her poetry, she reflected her alignment with the Black community, and her aesthetics emphasized art for the people rather than just art for art's sake. And like these poets, she took her art directly to the people. These poets, these new Black poets, they would be out there giving poetry readings and going to community centers and speaking on street corners and so forth. And so Harper came out of the oral tradition. And so she traveled widely, she went to churches, packed churches as a matter of fact, meeting halls, giving dramatic readings of her abolitionist poems, just as Sonia Sanchez, Mari Evans, Carol Rogers, Sarah Webster Fabio, the late Sarah Webster Fabio, and so forth. They based their protest poetry on direct imagery, on simple diction, rhythmic language of the street to reach the masses of people. Harper relied on similar elements. Her philosophy can be summarized in her poem, Songs for the People. I'll give you a little of it. Let me make songs for the people, songs for the old and the young, songs to stir a battle cry whenever they are sung. So, she wanted to reach the people just like these new Black poets did. Like them, she also expressed a deep pride in her Blackness. And they use a lot of irony and satiric portraiture and understatement. And so in maintaining her affiliation with the AME Church, as I said, she also helped to sustain this connection through her Black roots. She wrote about Black subjects like the Vashti, and she looked at the plight of women in slavery, like the slave mother, the slave auction, and she brought to light the Margaret Garner story, just as Toni Morrison did in Beloved. Now, so there are some similarities, but where they might differ was in, you know, these new Black poets, shunned the establishment, you know, they didn't want to assimilate. And so Sonia Sanchez, for example, one of the poems that I teach that by her called To Black Record Buyers. She said, I'm praying to your righteous brothers. White people ain't right about nothing no more. Don't tell me about foreign news. There's no black people are grooving on a Sunday afternoon. So, you know, they expressed this anger, you know, and they didn't want to assimilate with whites. But Harper, to them, you know, how would they have regarded, I don't, Sonia, that says she teaches Harper, but would she have taught her at that period in her life? I'm not certain.
Yes.
I'm just saying,
based on I taught Harper in the 60s, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, but I'm just, the way I'm looking at it, it's some of that anger, to me, it seems that, well, maybe someone like Jones, you know, Baraka, might have said, well, she's too much of an assimilationist, and that, you know, she was friends with John Brown, the abolitionist, and some of her poetry was inspired by Harriet Beecher Stowe, and she was a member of a Unitarian church, a largely white organization. So her abolitionist leanings might have turned some of these poets off. That's all I'm saying, because of the sentiment that they voiced. Some of these poets, I know, she was dubbed the architect of protest poetry. Some of the poets rejected the label protest. Larry Neal, for example, said that protest poetry was written expressly for black people and not for whites. So there's still this, you know, whites is the enemy. And so perhaps Harper, they would not see themselves, and some of them would not see themselves in the same vein as Harper in terms of being protest poets. Hakeem Olabuti, for example, describes protest as writing, which he says is, quote, a weak reaction to persons or events and often lacks the substance to motivate and move people, end of quote. So, you know, they were talking revolution, you know, something, they wanted something a little bit more powerful than just protest. So perhaps they would not have identified, all of them would not have identified with Harper as this protest poetry, although they could appreciate what it was she was doing, what she stood for. So poets that came of age during this period, this vibrant 1960s Black Arts Movement, like Carolyn Rogers, they owe a debt to Harper. Harper, who celebrated women just as Rogers did. And her poetry often delved into the challenges and problems facing African-American women. Poets with Maryland connections, like the late Lucille Clifton, who was the former poet laureate of Maryland. All of these women owe a debt to Harper. And in that she was a literary foremother to them. And so, not only poets from Maryland, but poets from elsewhere, form a lineage for which Harper provided a precedent and a premise, intertwining social and political causes into their poetic verses. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Amador. You've given us a great deal that perhaps we can argue about a little bit later on. But right now, I'd like to welcome to the stage Melba Joyce Boyd. She's a distinguished professor and chair of Africana Studies at Wayne State University. She is the author of 13 books, including Wrestling with the Muse, Dudley Randall and the Broadside Press, which received the 2005 Black Caucus of the American Library Association Book Honor for Nonfiction, and the editor of Roses and Revolutions, the Collected Writings of Dudley Randall, which also received the 2010 Library of Michigan Notable Books Award. She was a finalist in the 2010 NAACP Image Award in Literature. Ladies and gentlemen, Melba Joyce Boyd. right. I just got here from Detroit. Weather's a little bit better here. And I'm honored to be here, especially with Sonia, who I've known decades. I was assistant editor at Broadside Press, where Sonia published some of her first books of poetry. Lena I met through email. She asked me a literary question, I think, something she was dealing with in the classroom. I forget now, something about symbolism. So it's a small world. And I think she was the first person to mention about this was going to be taking place in Philadelphia. What was not included in my introduction is that I'm the author of Discarded Legacy, Politics and Poetics in the Life of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, 1825 to 1911.
Here it is.
And most specifically, why I was invited to be here. And I have to say that when the book came out, I got a wonderful review from the Philadelphia Inquirer. And the book was written during a time when, as Lena has indicated, that there was a lot of work being focused on women writers, in particular in African American studies, of black women writers who we were concerned about. Like Lena, I first encountered Frances Harper's work. The two most widely read and widely anthologized poems, which are Bury Me in a Free Land and The Slave Auction, in a collection, ironically, that we studied was Dudley Randall's The Black Poets. And Dudley then subsequently hired me as his assistant editor, and he became my mentor. Now, how I began to write the book is sort of one of those weird academic stories, which some of the room will appreciate. I'm a poet, and of those 13 books, nine of them are poetry. When I first started teaching in the system, as it were, I was at the University of Iowa, and I went through one of these changes. It's the whole tenure trick thing, you know. I had already published two collections of poetry. I had published several essays, and I was starting as an assistant professor. I had also just returned from Germany as a Fulbright scholar. So when I arrived, my senior colleagues felt that, well, okay, she writes poetry, but she needs to write a book of criticism. Now, that's not like everybody else in the department had to do all of that. But that's what I had to do. I was in the Department of English and in African American Studies. So I had been asked to write an article on black women poets in the 19th century for a German scholarly journal called Gulliver. And so when I returned to Iowa and started to do the research for this essay, I started with Frances Harper. And oddly enough, what happened was that I never got past Harper, because University of Iowa has a wonderful library. And they had several copies of the books that I'd only seen referenced in, say, the work of Eugene Redmond and Drum Voices Review. And I was just shocked, you know, at the mastery of these works, in particular Moses, The Story of the Nile. You know, a book-length, blank verse poem. No one, if you looked at any of the criticism that had been written about her, especially shortly after her death, by those persons who were supposed to be the deans of American literary heritage, ever mentioned some of her much more difficult pieces, that one, and Sketches of Southern Life, an amazing, amazing
poem that is written in the voice of Chloe, who was first begins as she starts out as an actual, I call it a slave narrative, because she's recalling what slavery was like, and then she takes you up through the Civil War and then into Reconstruction. And it's in the voice of Chloe. And the mastery of the dialect was just beyond anything that was going on when this book came out in 1869. It wasn't that stilted over apostrophes and deletions, which made the character, which usually made black characters look not just simply illiterate, but ignorant. The radicalism of the character's voice, her political clarity, was just amazing. And the reason those poems were so strong was I discovered when I came to Philadelphia to extend my research, and I came to this building. I did research here. I did, I went over to Temple, to the Bloxham collection, and it was, and they were just wonderful. I mean, they just brought out all this stuff and, you know, just laid it on the table. And so I stayed in Philadelphia for about a week, Xeroxing, you know. And then traveling down to Howard University and doing work in the Moreland Spingarn collection, where they also had pieces of work that I could not find anywhere else, not even in the Library of Congress. In fact, I went to the Library of Congress first, because that's what you're supposed to do, and they sent me to Howard. And when I got to the to Howard University, it was definitely, I knew that it was my destiny to write this book, because the librarian there, she said to me, "Wow, this is really fortuitous." And I said, "Why?" She says, "Because I just finished cataloging and cross-referencing all of the works we have on and about Frances Ellen Watkins Harper." I only had 1 week, because I was on my spring break. I'm also a mother, and at that time I left my children with my parents in Detroit, and so I was crashing at a friend's house, so you know how that was. And so at that point, all I did again was just like paying for Xerox, and you know, just took a load of stuff back with me, first to Detroit, and then you know, back to Iowa City. And what I found out, when I looked in all of these resources that I had, Harper had an amazing ear. And as a poet, if you don't have an ear, forget it, you're not a poet. And she had an appreciation for range and for difference of perspectives and so forth. And I found that in her letters, for example, to William Steele, she talked about women like Chloe, what they were doing, what they had experienced. And while she was lecturing in the South during the Reconstruction period, she broadened her vocabulary, her poetic vocabulary, as it were, and was able to really speak now and write in the sound and in the vocabulary of the newly freed people in the South. And she has that kind of range that is just was just amazing. And what I realized when I was reading all of this literature and reading her letters and reading her essays, many of the things that was happening in poetry, as Lena indicated, in the 20th century, especially in the latter part, I'd say even before the Black Arts Movement, you can see this affection for voice in the works of people like Dudley Randall and Robert Hayden and Gwendolyn Brooks and Robert Walker, who preceded the Black Arts Movement. And they were aware of Frances Harper. And so you can actually see a thread moving from the 19th century, the kinds of techniques that Frances Harper was using in her poetry, you could see in Margaret Walker. The kinds of and variations and perspectives and the capacity to both Right, in very sophisticated ways, and I think she did this more in her essays, specifically because oftentimes those essays were drawn from speeches that she was giving to audiences, black and white, and in an attempt to convince them, but also being in a position where she was literally representing the race. Maria Stewart was the first black woman, I think, to actually speak before an audience and a mixed audience. But Frances Harper, I think, took it to a whole nother level.
Yes.
She had been trained by her uncle to be an activist. And in that sense, her whole perspective was very different. Her attitude about marriage and values and prevailing values about woman's worth in marriage, she challenged in her writings and her short stories, The Two Offers, for example. She was in the forefront of going out and lecturing throughout the North and into Canada and throughout as far as she could go in the Midwest, in the Free States, trying to advocate for the cause of the end of slavery. And at the same time, never forgetting to interject the woman's voice, the woman's experience. And a lot of what had been absent, even when they were looking at her work, and I think in the reason some of these poems, for example, Moses, A Story of the Nile, and Sketches of Southern Life, I think they were ignored by these male critics because these were poems that were written primarily in the voice and perspective of women. Even though Moses, is, A Story of the Nile, is about the rebellion of Moses and leading the Hebrew people out of slavery, she incorporates into that poem the importance of women, both in terms of his real mother, who taught him the Hebrew tradition and religion, as well as his adopted mother, the princess, who tried to transform him into a king and hopefully to become a king of the land, which, of course, he ultimately rebelled against. So what happens, I think, is that innate sexism that existed in the American community, both black and white, caused many of these men to sort of ignore what was going on in her literature. She gets shelved or she gets pushed to the side. And this is the moment where I always like, you know, thank God for librarians. Because what librarians have done in this country, what academics have not done, and that is they just hold on to it. They hold on to it. They bound it in hardcovers, and you know, and when you show up, they say, here it is, Melba, right there for you, you know, now go to work. And that's, it was really sort of, for me, I felt like my fate in many ways to write this book. It was this request to write this essay, which by the way, I wrote the essay and it was rejected. And I was told, because I wrote it all about Harper, that I didn't understand Frances Harper, so that was like really weird. But I said, well, you know, forget it. I'm just gonna write the whole book, because I had these other people saying, well, if you don't write a book, you know, you can't really stay, you're not gonna get tenure. And I needed tenure because I had two children, I was recently divorced, and I needed health care. So I said, well, I can do this. You know, I can do this, but I would like to read a bit from one of Harper's essays, and it's called Our Greatest Wants, and then I'm gonna comment on that and make this connection to why Frances Harper is so important, not just to the literary community, but to American society in general, that she is someone that needs to be taught. And all students need to know who she is, and I think that her voice is as relevant today as it was in 1854 when she first started speaking publicly. I like the character of Moses. He is the first disunionist we read of in the Jewish scripture. Magnificence of Pharaoh's throne loomed up before his vision. His oriental splendors glittered before his eyes, but he turned from them all and chose rather to suffer with the enslaved than rejoice with the free. He would have no union with the slave power in Egypt. When we have a race of men whom this blood-stained government cannot tempt or flatter, who would sternly refuse every office in the nation's gift, from a president down to a tie waiter, until she shook her hands from complicity in the guilt of cradle plundering and man stealing. Then for us, the foundations of an historic character will have been laid. We need men and women whose hearts are the homes of a high and lofty enthusiasm and a noble devotion to the cause of emancipation, who are ready and willing to lay time, talent, and money on the altar of universal freedom. We have money among us, but how much of it is spent to bring deliverance to our captive brethren? Our wealthiest men, the most liberal sustainers of the anti-slavery enterprise? Or does the bare fact of their having money really help mold public opinion and reverse its sentiments? We need what money cannot buy and what affluence is too beguardly to purchase. Earnest, self-sacrificing souls that will stamp themselves not only on the present, but the future. Let us not then defer all our noble opportunities till we get rich. And here I am, not aiming to enlist a fanatical crusade against the desire for riches, but I do protest against chaining down the soul with its heaven-endowed faculties and God-given attributes to the one idea of getting money and stepping into power or even gaining our rights in common with others. The respect that is only brought by gold is not worth much. It is no honor to shake hands politically with men who whip women and steal babies. If this government has no call for our services, no aim for your children, we have the greater need of them to build up a true manhood and womanhood for ourselves. The important lesson we should hear and be able to teach is how to make every gift, whether gold or talent, fortune or genius, subserve the cause of crushed humanity and carry out the greatest idea of the present age, the glorious idea of human brotherhood. That's Grace Sullivan. Now this piece was written by Frances Harper in 1859, and yet it is as relevant today as it was 150 years ago. Harper challenges obsessive materialism and the myth that dignity and respect can be purchased, and if it can, it is worthless. In this historical instance, the quest for freedom is literal because of the existence of slavery. Today, pervasive poverty, a bankrupt public education system, reactionary political movements, and the internalized destruction of the black community as a consequence of drug trafficking, high unemployment, and homicidal conditions. This reality is as debilitating as iron shackles. But to what extent have we invested our wealth into saving our children, into eradicating the ravages of poverty and internalized self-hatred? At the same time, some of the most fortunate divorce themselves from any affiliation with the oppressed, reside in gated suburban communities, and deny any sense of responsibility to extend their resources or their wealth to the unfortunate. In an 1866 speech before the Women's Rights Convention, Harper identifies the courage of Harriet Tubman, the Moses who exemplified the uncanny strength of women invested in faith. We cannot fully appreciate Harper's vision without acknowledging her radical vision, which is focused on the conditions that control and threaten the future of black women. Harper brought attention to the particular circumstances of enslaved women, as well as the shortcomings of a, quote, free society, as it related to the welfare and undemocratic realities that restricted prospects for a full and complete democracy. I'm gonna skip a little here. Harper gave voice to women in slavery and in a so-called free society. She challenged traditional marriage and insisted on the importance of education and employment for women in order for them to acquire equal status in the home and in the public sphere. This vision was not unique to Harper's vision, but rather she reported and documented the occurrence of this liberating perspective as it evolved in progressive communities, black and white. And I quote from one of her pieces. The women, and this is her reporting on her experiences during Reconstruction, and she's traveling through the South, she's teaching and helping to set up schools. The women as a class are quite equal to the men in energy and executive ability. In fact, I find by close observation that the mothers are the levers which move in education. The men talk about it, especially about election time, if they want an office for self or their candidate, but the women work most for it. They labor in many ways to support the family while the children attend school. They make great sacrifices to spare their own children during school hours. I know girls from 16 to 22 who iron till midnight that they may come to school in the day. Some of our scholars aged about 19, living about 30 miles off, rented land, plowed, planted, and sold their cotton in order to come to us. A woman near me urged her husband to in debt $500 for a home, as the titles to the land they had built on were insecure, and she said to me, "We have 5 years to pay it in, and I shall begin today to do it, if life is spared. I will make $100 at washing before I have done it, yet they have seven little children to feed, clothe, and educate. In the field, the women receive the same wages as the men and are often preferred, clearing land, hoeing, or picking cotton with equal ability." Now she's talking about what Black women are doing in the South after Reconstruction. She's not making any of this up. And then when you read the poems that she writes coming out of these experiences, she is giving voice to these women, and this is coming out of real history. But also, what she's talking about are the things that we're still fighting for today. Same work, equal pay. You know, and it has changed, but it hasn't changed that much. You have to struggle for everything you get. Your public's gonna take it all away from us anyway, I won't go there. Unfortunately, because most of Harper's work went out of print and could only be found with special collections, and it's often the case, because she was a woman, her work was not preserved or kept current for Black audiences or white audiences. We lost most ground in the lost years, but true thoughts are not limited to a particular history. And as the abolitionist movement gave way to the women's rights movement, the modern civil rights movement instigated the women's movement, and more specifically, the womanist movement. The retrieval of Frances Harper's writing reveals the consistency in progressive Black women's thought. Her characters cut to the chase and take no prisoners. Take, for example, the voice of Aunt Chloe. Now, this is from Sketches of Southern Life. "I think that Samuel Johnson said his side had won the day had not we women radicals just got right in the way. And yet I would not have you think that all our men are shabby, but 'tis said in every flock of sheep there will be one that's scabby. I've heard before election came they tried to buy John Slade, but he gave them all to understand that he wasn't in that trade. And we've got lots of other men who rally around the cause and go for holding up the hand that gave us equal laws, who know their freedom costs too much of blood and pain and treasure for them to fool away their votes for profit or for pleasure. Of course, I don't know much about these politics, but I think that some who run them do mighty ugly tricks. I've seen them honey fool around and talk so awful sweet that you think they're full of kindness as an egg is full of meat. Now, I don't believe in looking honest people in the face and saying when you're doing wrong that I haven't sold my race. When we want to school our children, if the money isn't there, whether Black or white have took it, the loss we all must share. And if this buying up each other is something worse than mean, though I think's a heap of voting, I go for voting clean." Now, we all know we could be reading that poem. I know you can read it in Detroit, and I really am not going to go there, because that's a real tragic situation. I'm going to try to wind up here. But at any rate, what I said that here today, I tried to delineate these points that are in my book, Discarded Legacy, which is arranged in three sections, the abolitionist years, pursuit of the promised land, and the women's era. And yet within this historical arrangement, there is a consistency in Harper's investment in the welfare of African Americans, revealing the tyranny of sexism and the inequity of social classes in a democracy that espouses equality. This triad comprises the concentric circles that reflect, overlap, and reiterate the triangular formulations of oppression that still undermine American society and culture today. Harper's literary thesis is an antithesis confronting literary and social traditions. In a postscript to the novel Minnie's Sacrifice, she refutes the popular fiction of law and custom, which valued caste and gender as class positions determined relative to the power of white supremacy. And she says, and she does this, she wrote this really, it's an amazing novel, because the main character looks white, but she's black, and then she goes and does work on the Reconstruction era, and I don't want to tell you more of that because I want you to read the novel. But at the end, she would make these notes. So like, if you didn't really understand the novel, she's going to tell you what you're supposed to get from it. The lesson of Minnie's Sacrifice is this, that it is braver to suffer with one's own branch of the human race, to feel that the weaker and the more despised they are, the closer we will cling to them for the sake of helping them, than to attempt to creep out of all identity with them in their feebleness for the sake of mere personal advantages, and to do this at the expense of self-respect and a true manhood and a truly dignified womanhood, that with whatever gifts we possess, whether they be genius, culture, wealth, or social position, we can best serve the interests of our race by a generous and loving diffusion than by a narrow and selfish isolation, which, after all, is only one type of the barbarous and anti-social state. I'd like to conclude my presentation by quoting a stanza from the poem, A Double Standard, which this poem is always my students' favorites, especially when I teach the course on Black women in America. And the lines go like this. Can you blame me if I've learned to think your hate a vice, a crime, a shame? When you so coldly crush me down and then excuse the man. Thank you. Can we give everyone a hand? Book again, I was remiss to miss it, not the 1994 book, Discarded Legacy, Politics and Poetics in the Life of Frances E.W. Harper, 1825 to 1911. So ladies, one of the things that I'd like you to start us off with, and perhaps Dr. Boyd, you'll perhaps take this first question, to paint a picture of the kind of courageousness it must have taken for Frances Harper to travel and to do the work that she did at this time. Not just black, but black and female. And how you see that courageousness embedded in the work.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Well, you know, to be, first of all, people were killed and lynched for speaking against slavery. And you didn't have to be a black woman for that to happen to you. But most certainly to assume the responsibility to go out there and to be up front and to have to deal with all of the possibilities. I think it's in a way, I don't know, I think it happens at different periods in history, and it happens over and over again. When Lena talked about protest in the 60s, I remember when I was a freshman at Western Michigan University in 1968, and Dr. King was assassinated. And we took over the student union and staged our protest. We had planned to do that at another time, but his assassination prompted us to do something right then. And they called the National Guard, the Michigan National Guard. Now, mind you, I was from Detroit in 1967, just a year before. I know what the National Guard does. The National Guard, for the most part, come from parts of the state of Michigan that don't care anything about black people, Indian, or, you know, dark people. And a lot of the people who died in the 67 riot were killed by the National Guard in particular. So there's always been these dangerous periods, I think, in history. And when you read Harper, just like Harriet Tubman, they were women of great faith. And I really believe that was what, you know, girded her and gave her, and then she writes about that when she's traveling through the South, and there had just been a lynching of a young girl, a young black girl, at the place where she was traveling to. And she says, you know, but I am not afraid. You know, I'm aware, but I am not afraid. And she'd have these conversations, and she would say, with some of the people who still believed in the Confederacy. There's still people who still believe in the Confederacy. So I really don't think about it but I think that sort of danger has been in place for black people since they came to these shores, and especially when you're talking back, because essentially that's what she's doing. She's talking back, and what I read you was really like to some of the stuff that she said, like about the president. I mean, she was out there. She did not hold her tongue in any way. So I think that it was what she felt she was born to do, and I think she followed what was, you know, her path.
Could I add to it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why. Can you hear?
Yeah.
That's why we were asked to do 10 minutes, and that's why I did that 10-minute piece about the thunder of an angel. Because it's very interesting, this woman. She came out thunderously, if you read her, right? But also she was this angel, because she was a very Christian woman also, too. So that here we see this kind of interesting kind of dichotomy there with her, very proper woman. But also you hear her say something like this and traveling, and then you see how close we all are as women in this business called being on the road and writing and lecturing. She will say, "My lungs are weak. I need rest." December 9th, 1859. "I am in Ohio now and speaking on the fugitive bill. Is it not shocking, the boldness of the slave hunters since the triumph of the slave power in northern Ohio, that wretched swapping affair? Did you see the account of a late arrest of a man to whom about 15 minutes trial was given, 15 minutes to bid adieu to freedom, and then to be cast into the gaping jaws of American despotism? Oh, my friend, do you not sometimes feel almost heart-sickened? But you, in your mountain home, only hear of these things. What must it be to dwell in the midst of them? Now, will you write to me as soon as possible? I shall not long make any demands on your friendship. The doctor thinks my lungs are weak and that I need more rest than medicine. The rest may soon be the unbroken slumber of the grave. Well, I hope that the everlasting arms will shield me forever from the guilt, the power, and pollution of sin. There, the mortal woe and sorrow may never surge against me, and these cries of wrong and suffering never enter to wake up my soul and disturb me. Should I not be permitted to labor much longer, will you not remember my poor, blighted, and crushed people and do what you can for them? Virginia has sacrificed that dear old man, Brown, who laid his hands upon the bloody citadel of American slavery and shook the guilty fabric to its base. Shall not, my dear friend, his blood be a fresh baptism of freedom, his grave a new altar where men may record more earnest vows against slavery? Shall it not intensify your hatred of slavery and deepen your love of freedom and give you fresh vigor to battle for justice and right?" And then she will write to to Brown's wife, to Mary Brown. My dear madam, in an hour like this, the common words of sympathy may seem like idle words, and yet I want to say something to you, the noble wife of the hero of the 19th century. Belonging to the race, your dear husband reached forth his hand to assist. I need not tell you that my sympathies are with you. I thank you for the brave words you have spoken. A republic that produces such a wife and mother may hope for better days. And then she writes to Brown. And the whole point of this is that what you really see with this woman is this understanding of better days. Because I was a professor, I had to teach her. It had nothing to do with whether she liked, you know, white folks or not. That was not the premise for you teach. When you are a professor and you are a scholar, you teach what is there. And you had to teach this woman because she and this woman who came before her, Phyllis Wheatley, this is the tradition. When I started the course, I started the first course in America called The Black Woman in a place called the University of Pitt. And these are the women you had to teach at the very beginning because they told us about what was going on in a place called America. So it's not like your feelings or what you think. What we were talking about is that no one was hating all white folks. We were saying simply, you got to look and understand what this is truly all about. Here in this place called America, you have oppressed us, period. You know, I always say to people, if at one point all of a sudden someone tells you that you've been oppressed, and we were never told that we were enslaved. Can you imagine being educated in America and never told you were enslaved, and then all of a sudden you find it, you're not gonna say, by golly, by gee, I think I was enslaved, you know? You come out really, you know, shooting darts, you know? And that is what we understand, too, with this woman who was genteel, but at the same time was, you know, an earthquake, you know? She moved out with the thunder, and you had to listen to her very carefully. And with joy and with love.
Courageous and gentle, and yet there's an element of faith that keeps her moving. Yes, Lena.
And I just wanted to add that it's something I raised earlier today, that, you know, often people think, well, wasn't she afraid to go in the South and to lecture in the South? Wasn't she afraid for her life? And I was really surprised when I found out that she really, one of the places where she was most harassed and intimidated was right here in Pennsylvania.
Always.
She talks about on the Carlisle Road that there were some men who kept insulting her and kept intimidating and harassing her, but she continued. She persevered.
Mm. Thank you.
Could you hold your point for just 1 second? I just wanted to tie this, or have you at least go a little bit further about this idea of faith. Is that what gives us the kind of tremendous talent that she was? Was it her Christian faith? Was it her ties to the Unitarian and the AME Church? Was that what allowed her the access into the jaws of whatever danger we want to call that? Or was it the necessity to educate because she learned that from her uncle? Which of those two, or was it a combination of them?
I mean, I think she was, you know, she was who she was and she knew who she was. And she was a pioneer, you know, as we've all indicated in our presentation. She was an activist. I mean, she was a revolutionary. She was devoted to ending slavery, and the need to end slavery, which she keeps reminding the free community, is, you know, your situation is going to continue to be as bad as it is as long as slavery exists, and that free people were being kidnapped and sold into slavery. And she would talk about these things. So you were never completely free because black people were not full citizens. And so they were always, you know, in danger. So I guess you could try to avoid danger as much as you can. But at the same time,
because there were some people who did at that time. So was, what gave her that girth?
Well, her uncle was an activist. She was surrounded by activism. She was raised up in a family that was used to challenging and talking back. And he was a person who was he was a scholar. His uncle was a scholar. He was a poet as well. She was trained at a school that obviously was not, she was trained in a classical education. She knew German, French, Latin, Greek. But she also, they reported that every day they had to write an essay. Every day. I tell my students, I said, you think you got it bad. I said, if you were really in training, you'd be writing every day. And so she, everything she did was for that purpose. And faith was a part of that. I mean, the abolitionist movement was a movement that was grounded and promoted by radical Christians. I mean, whether it's Nat Turner or it's John Brown or it's, I'm trying to think of the
Denmark
Vesey. I mean, they believed that God was on their side, and they actually... They were Christians, but they were what we call liberationists. I mean, their view of Christianity was not this where you just listen what Master say and then you die and then you go to slave heaven. There were two kinds of churches that were operating at that time. One advocated, you know, liberation. Moses is a very important character because Moses was a liberator. Christ, you said, also picked, you said, is a liberator. And if you live in Christ and Christ becomes a part of you. Now, about the her religious training, the AME Church became a radical offshoot of the Methodists because the Methodists would not take a position against slavery. And so that's how that happened. But also in terms of her experience as a woman, she became a Unitarian because, you know, the AME still has some serious women's issues. They have women issues. And so she continued to work with the AME Church. She continued to teach Sunday school right here in Philadelphia. But the Unitarian Church had a more enlightened view of women. And I find that there are a lot of consistency. Sonia and I were at the University of Massachusetts mm-hmm. in November mm-hmm. For celebrating the 4th anniversary of the African American Studies program. And I was talking there about how when I was doing my research on Dudley Randall and writing mm-hmm. his biography, that there were such strong similarities to his grandparents who had been born slaves. They come out, start their own farm, start their own, you know, wholesale grocery business. And these are his grandparents. They made sure all their children were educated, that they went to college. And so this, what Harper's talking about, what black people are doing, this is more pervasive than contemporary society wants us to believe. Literacy in the black community was higher during the Reconstruction era than it is right today.
That's right.
Now, you know, and that's a damn shame. Excuse my French. But the people were motivated, they were inspired, and there was opportunity until they started, of course, until they shut down the Reconstruction, burning schools, burning churches, and they stopped all of that enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So when you consider, you know, what was her motivation, but she was a woman based in faith. She was extremely well educated. She read and related and made allusions to all of the major writers of that time. They were interfacing with these leading writers who were, you know, in joining the abolitionist movement. She was being read in England and all of these other places and making references to Goethe and writing about. So she could write any way she wanted to, and she would demonstrate that when you look at her range of articulation. But the thing is that either you, I think these choices come to black people in this country all the time. You will be tested at different points, and either you're going to be scared, or you might as well just go home and sit down and shut up. And some people do that, and other people, they understand that calling and would rather live fearlessly than to live in the shadows and to be, you know, less than who you can be as a human being.
And I think that's where the connective threads come, you know, from her also too. And because I'm retired now, I was a professor for 40 years, we changed the language. When we taught the so-called slave narrative, we changed the language to freedom narratives. Mm-hmm. They are not slave narratives, they're freedom narratives, you know? You had to change the language, you changed the language. That's the joy of teaching, you know, because you learn when you teach. I mean, it's an amazing thing, teaching. And the other thing, too, is that we realized that she was a middle-class woman. So it's always, in quotes, much easier sometimes for middle-class people to move towards change, you know? You have the time. I know that sounds weird, you know, but you understand what I'm saying. You have the time, you have the money, you have, you know, the education also, too. And you're not out there, you know, running to make a living, living. Although this woman did do that also, too. But she had all of that. And so, therefore, it was much easier for her then, you know, to affect this thing called change.
And she didn't marry early.
No, she did not.
She did not marry early.
I thought she wasn't going to marry at all.
Yeah, she didn't marry early.
Very conscious of her own reproductive rights.
And I would add another thing that motivated her would be her sense of outrage. And I see her as the outraged mother, which she writes about, the slave mother, the slave auction, bury me in a free land, review that mother's shriek. So she lost her mother at a very early age. And so she would always take the side of the mother, and this mother, this slave mother, who would rather kill her children, the Margaret Garner story, than to see them be enslaved. So she was just incensed. And also she was motivated to go on the speaking to the circuit because she had seen, a fugitive slave, a person sold, who was free, sold into slavery. And that could very well have happened to her she had re-entered her home state of Maryland.
Can we thank these women for resurrecting Black America?